You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots, community supported, solar powered, all good things radio.
Right, and it's solar powered today.
It is. We're having a beautiful day today here in sunny Iowa with the snow on the ground, but melting quickly.
Yes. Like Monica says, this is how you do winter. Yeah. Snows at night and then melts the next day.
And you are listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Coburn, who fortunately was able to make it through the snow on
yes.
over here. Or she lives half an hour away from Fairfield.
Well, I think that the crews were out. The road crews must have been out because the roads were quite good. So they were out.
And this is the show where we talk to writers, editors, agents, publicists, and other people who are involved in the world of books. Caroline, do you want to introduce our guests today?
I would like to. We have two guests. Dr. Brenda Hunter, PhD, is a psychologist and internationally published author, educated at Wheaton College and Georgetown University. She has served on two presidential commissions and written numerous books, including Home by Choice, In the Company of Women, and The Power of Mother Love. And the one that we're doing today is From Santa to Sexting, something all parents should read this book, absolutely. Our other guest is, and her co-author, Kristen Blair, is an education columnist and writer. Her articles have appeared in numerous publications, including The Charlotte Observer, The Durham Herald Sun, and Carolina Journal. She's worked on family and education policy at the national level for the government, Presidential Commission, and Empower America. Welcome, ladies. We're so happy to have you.
We're glad to be here.
We're glad to be.
From Santa to Sexting is the subtitle is Helping Your Child Safely Navigate Middle School and Shape the Choices That Last a Lifetime. An important topic. What drew the two of you to this topic?
Well, both of us are researchers and both of us are writers. And we became quite concerned with what we were seeing pass over our desks about really what was happening to middle schoolers in America. You know, this is a pivotal time for young people growing up, the years from 11 to 14. It's a very important time in child development, and it's a time when these kids are making choices that can really affect later years.
The other thing that we noticed, Monica and Carolyn, is that this is really a neglected age group in the literature. There's a lot out there about babies and toddlerhood and certainly a lot mm-hmm. about older adolescents, but this particular mm-hmm. age group of 11 to 14 years old is somewhat neglected in the literature, and we wanted to provide a roadmap for parents for what it was like to parent tweens and young teens through this stage of development in America today.
Well, I know it's changed a lot since I started teaching in seventh grade in 84. Mm-hmm. And I know there weren't these problems then, but I know this. That's why I say this book is so vitally important for parents to read, because it encompasses the things that they have to watch out for. And parents, I'm sorry to say, a lot of parents are abdicating their authority and their ability to control their kids. And let's face it, you have to set some boundaries. And when you don't, that's what we have troubles with.
Well, I think that's right. And one of the things we became quite aware of as we interviewed principals, teachers, psychologists who work with this age group is the fact that in America today, many parents have sort of abdicated the role of the authority figure in their children's lives. We were told again and again that parents just want to be friends and buddies. They don't want to be authority figures. When they come home at the end of the day tired, they don't want to say, no, you can't have that cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, just to make sure that our listeners know who's speaking, could you each introduce yourself so that we know which voice goes with which name?
Sure. I wanted to pick up. This is Kristen.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You had mentioned about the importance of boundaries, and one area where this is is particularly clear is in the area of media. 11 to 14 year olds today inhabit a media mad world, and they consume on average 9 hours per day.
Oh my gosh!
Of recreational media, purely just for enjoyment. This doesn't include the time they spend with media on school.
9 hours a day.
9 hours per day, and interestingly, only about a third of kids say that they have any parental rules on time that they spend with media consumed from computers and television, video games, that sort of thing. Yet,
wow.
Rules and kids who spend less time with media are happier, less bored, and do better in school.
That's mind-boggling.
Well, I know for a fact that parents, some parents today expect the school to teach their children manners, to teach them decorum, to teach them respect for authority, and it ain't going to happen. The school can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do the best they can sometimes.
Well, yeah, they do the best.
I think that's true. This is Brenda Hunter speaking here. We found that a lot of parents are outsourcing the major aspects of child rearing. And we spoke with a principal who had bought a dress for a dance for one of her eighth graders. And a number of the teachers talked about being surrogate parents mm-hmm. to the middle schoolers that they work with. Our book really attempts to inform and encourage parents to be gatekeepers of their homes, to be protective of their children as parents used to be a decade or two ago.
Right. Yeah.
So you think things have changed drastically in the last couple of decades?
Absolutely. I think part of it, too, though, is parents don't have that sense of personal empowerment. One of the youth directors that we interviewed said that he reminds parents at the beginning of each year and says, if your child turns out great, it's not because of me. If your child doesn't turn out well, it's not because of me either. I'm here to help you, but I'm not here to take your place.
Mm. You know, my children were in this age group in the late 80s, early 90s, and so they, you know, some of the challenges that parents face now, we didn't really have to deal with, but some others we did, and I my recollection of that time period is it's actually one of my least favorite ages for children.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
I think, this is Brenda, I think you are in a large crowd of people.
We're not alone. You're not alone.
Suffered in middle school. Many people say, oh, that's the worst, was the worst time in my life. And the kids today, though, they are encountering pressures from the culture that nobody in this interview ever encountered. Mm. And these kids are growing up in the most digitized and technologically advanced mm. period of our world's history. And one of the things that that I have written about in our book is that girls are growing up at warp speed, girls and boys, but girls especially are too sexy too soon. A 2007 APA summary stated that the sexualization of girls is rampant in America. It begins in infancy, it continues through high school. And I don't know if you've been aware of the clothing.
Yeah, I'm just going to say
that
the
young girls are aware that's out there for mothers and grandmothers to buy. It really is too sexy too soon.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're
yeah,
right.
When you in your book you talk about that and how like these pageants for the young girls, and I mean it's appalling, really. It's you wonder why are adults doing this to children? They're not doing it to themselves.
Yeah, why are they doing it?
Well, do you want to answer this, Chrissy?
Well, I think part of the challenge I do think is in what's available. And I know one of the women that we mentioned in the book, Dana Gresh, has really protested what's available through her initiative, The Modesty Project, and trying to raise awareness among retailers and sort of advocate for different kinds of choices. So I think that's part of the problem. I think part of it is the messages that kids hear and see in the media in terms of what's appropriate or what's standard. And
mm-hmm.
there are a lot of different messages that they're getting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about how this book came to be. How did the, so you both, did you both have interest in this area before you got together to write this book?
I think we did for different reasons. I'm a psychologist. I also am a practicing psychotherapist in Raleigh, North Carolina. And as I began to work with young women in their 20s, I found that some of them had started having sex at 14 years of age, and then they would have several partners throughout high school. And I looked at what this did to them. They would come to me depressed and with low self-esteem. And I became very concerned then about the sexualization of girls and about what happens to boys and girls when they begin having sex too early. And the research out there indicates that they generally will have more sexual partners in their lifetime, that they will often take alcohol or drugs before they have sex, and that they will have unprotected sex. So there really is fallout from early sexual experience, and that hooked me.
I think, this is Kristen speaking, I'm an education columnist and writer, and have been working in the family policy and educational realm for many years. And so I've seen a lot of research and material come across my desk, and have written quite a bit about what kids are dealing with, not just in the academic realm, but also some on cyberbullying. And just as current trends and other things are shaping this stage of development. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I noticed that this group is really a neglected age group, and there's not a lot of attention devoted to their unique set of circumstances and specific needs.
Right. And then how did you two come together?
Well, sort of like you did.
Are you mother and daughter?
Yeah,
we are.
Okay. Works for me.
I wondered if that was the case.
Well, we're in the preface to our book, we do, we admit.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. We actually wrote a book together in 1995 on marriage preparation, so we've been around this mountain before.
Okay. So let's
with different and particularly in terms of the extremely substantive nature of the content that we went through mm-hmm. in the interviews.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the process of how this book came together then. You both had information. How did you decide what the focus of the book would be, how to structure it, and then how to work together to create the whole?
Well, one of the first things we did was we went to McLean Bible Church in Northern Virginia. It's a mega church. And we addressed a focus group there of parents of middle school kids, and we wanted to find out what their concerns were. We wrote about it, actually, in the first chapter. And what we heard was they felt they had lost control. They were very worried about oral sex and real sex. They were worried about what their kids were exposed to in public school. And we picked up a lot of parental anxiety. So that was the first thing we did to sort of help structure the way we went.
This is Kristen. Another theme that emerged to us was this notion of broken down walls mm-hmm. in the family. And for that, we went to the book of Nehemiah and looked at the process where Nehemiah inspects sort of the walls surrounding Jerusalem and starts this process of rebuilding. And I think mm-hmm. throughout this whole experience, our hope has been that through informing parents and encouraging them, we will also empower them to rebuild some of these walls, or if there are strong family walls, to strengthen and fortify these family walls. Not that the home would be a fortress, but that parents could be the wise gatekeepers of their homes.
Well,
and you know, the interesting thing is what both of us have heard from marketeers is that they believe there are no gatekeepers in the families of America anymore. Years ago, a marketer said, we don't have to worry about mothers anymore. They're no longer the gatekeepers of the family. And, you know, when you don't have gates and gatekeepers, anything can go in and out of the family.
That's true.
That's right. This is Kristen. I attended an internet summit this past fall, and the keynote speaker, this was a summit for digital marketers, the keynote speaker said, the gatekeepers of society have lost their keys.
Hmm.
And we want parents to find, we want to encourage parents to find them again.
Now, they're not going to, some of these teenagers who have had carte blanche, so to speak, and freedoms are not going to, they're not going to subdue quietly. They're going to, the parents are going to meet some resistance. And that's when you really have to get tough, isn't it? Because they really have to stand up, because it would be easy to cave at that point, I would think.
Do you give some advice on how to
hold the fort?
How to hold the fort without ending up with the rebellion?
Well, you know, a couple of answers to, this is Brenda, a couple of answers to your questions. Every chapter we have has, we call it parent tips.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the chapter, we give very practical advice to parents, and our early readers of the book really appreciate that. But I would just like to say to parents, there will always be some rebellion.
Right.
That's what this age group is all about.
Yeah, that's
the age. These kids are, in this stage of development, they're beginning to develop self-awareness, a self. Their brains are maturing. They're not mature yet. And one writer said that they're, it's like the foot is on the gas pedal instead, and there's no brake. However, the parent has to have enough sense of self to be able to say no and mean it. And we heard again and again that many parents can't say no.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kristen, too. I think one of the other things that we would encourage is to take the long-range view, that it's a process, and there are going to be times when parents and children don't see eye to eye. It has ever been thus, right?
Right.
True.
That's right. So to take the long range view, and this takes a lot of energy, long term thinking, initiative, but it is absolutely worth it. And these decisions that kids are making have such long range implications now, and making good choices during this time have profound benefits across the lifespan.
One thing that's important to remember is if you think back to when you were this age, unless you're different than me, you will recall that you did a lot of things behind your parents' back.
No.
That they didn't know about. That, you know, I was in a family that there were certainly plenty of walls, and I climbed over them every chance I could get.
Okay. She turned out good, though. She turned out really good.
Right. So I turned out fine. And the same with my kids. I was less strict with my kids just because it's not easy. I don't like being strict. I had one main rule that I insisted on and never backed down from, and that is be kind. And I felt like pretty much everything else was if I instilled that in my children, that they might make mistakes, but they weren't going to go too far off the track.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would always come back to that, and it did. You know, they did. Both those things happened. So you're right. You know, you can make the rules. They're going to get broken, and you don't have to feel like you're failing. If that's the case,
no, it doesn't have to be the end of the process. If there's some backsliding, you know, you read about teenage angst. I love that word because it's perfect angst. That's just a perfect word, isn't it?
Yeah. So when you started writing the book, you talked about the structure. You've got the parent tips at the end. You also have a lot of sort of personal stories included in the book. What made you decide to do that, and how would you like to share some of that with us?
Well, we were very conscious that we wanted to have research, we wanted to have interviews with the experts, and we wanted to have interviews with parents and some of the kids themselves. But we also felt we wanted to have some vulnerability in the book. And the best way to do it, we decided, was to do personal vignettes. And these are shaded in the book, so they're in contrast to the rest of the text. And when I began publishing in, this is Brenda, 1978, my first literary agent said to me, he was quoting Robert Frost, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." So we tried to just be very cognizant of that and be brave enough to share some of our periods of humiliation.
So
that's right. We wanted to share some of our experiences and some of the things that we've learned in the process, and also some vulnerability. And I have a story in the book that I've actually gotten a lot of feedback on, which was when I was in seventh grade and was voted off my lunch table.
Oh.
And I think a lot of people identify. I think Carolyn used that word, angst.
Yes,
yes. The tween angst identified there.
Yeah, right.
Wow. So would you like to read something from the book?
Sure. This is Kristen. I'll go ahead and read this brief vignette about the cafeteria.
That would be great.
Okay. How well I remember the middle school cafeteria. It was the site of my greatest rejection in middle childhood. Seventh grade started out as a challenging year for me. I had a skinny body, unforgiving limp hair, and an enormous orthodontic appendage. The official nomenclature indicated it was a bionator, a top and bottom retainer all in one. But really, it should have had a far more nefarious name. All during seventh grade, I wore this cruel contraption around the clock. I talked with it, teeth clenched together. I slept with it. So attired, I plunged into the seventh grade lunchroom at Sparta Junior High School in northern New Jersey. Fortunately, I had a small group of friends from elementary school who welcomed me to their lunch table. Sandy, an easygoing tomboy, and Corey, a petite girl with scoliosis who wore a back brace, occupied a table in the corner of the lunchroom with several other girls and me. But one day in late spring, as I was eating my lunch, a slip of paper circulated around the table. I watched, puzzled, as several girls signed it. As it made its way to Sandy, the leader of our group, she opened it and informed me that the girls had conducted a vote. They had just decided, via their own brutal brand of adolescent democracy, that I was no longer welcome at the lunch table. I had been voted off, effective immediately. Momentarily frozen, I quickly gathered my things and left. I felt embarrassed, stricken, and deeply rejected. Mercifully, I had only a few lonely weeks of school to endure before seventh grade, and my interface with the lunchroom mean girls ended. That summer, my family relocated to Vienna, Virginia, so I had the chance to start over in eighth grade at a new middle school, outfitted with normal braces and a fresh identity. I could reinvent myself. But even now, almost 30 years later, I can still recall the sting of my public humiliation in the middle school cafeteria.
And that is what I don't like about kids that age, that they do things like that.
Did they ever tell you why you were voted off?
Not that I can recall.
Wow.
And it was fortunately, as I mentioned, towards the end of the end of the school year, and we moved shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that was fortunate for you.
No information and resolution that I can remember.
Now, Dr. Hunter, were you aware of this incident in Kristen's life?
I was indeed. I do believe my husband called the father of one of the girls, the instigator of the whole rejection paper. But it was very painful. I think the thing that helped me deal with it was that I had a similar experience. When I was in sixth grade, I was in a group of four girls, and I got a telephone call from Kay Azell, the ringleader, telling me that I was no longer a part of the group. So I could identify with Kristen's humiliation and her pain. I think I hope it helped her.
Yeah.
But it's a common experience. And you brought up something. This is a tumultuous age for a lot of kids. It's a time when they're supremely self-conscious. And in fact, one academic said that the most important decision a middle schooler makes is in that sixth grade, when he gets his food in the cafeteria and he looks out over the room and decides where he's going to sit. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is stress. This is high stress time. And that's why we believe that parents need to stay engaged with their kids during this stage of development. This is a time, we were told by educators, when many parents disengage, because these kids begin walking around with adult-looking bodies, and, you know, they are pushing parents away anyway. So the tendency is to assume that they're a more adult than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
But we believe that parents need to stay engaged, and they need to be there after school or shortly thereafter to hear their child unload about the day. Mm. Find out what's going on in the kid's life. In fact, one of the themes that emerges from all of our interviews is that it's the child of the unaware parent who gets into trouble. Repeatedly, we heard this from people we interviewed.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Dr. Brenda Hunter and Kristen Blair, authors of From Santa to Sexting, Helping Your Child Safely Navigate Middle School and Shape the Choices That Last a Lifetime. And this is published by Leafwood Publishers.
Have you ladies ever seen that cartoon in the funny papers, Zits? Have you ever seen that cartoon?
I missed the latter part of what you said.
Oh, have you ever seen
what's
that cartoon
called?
The cartoon in the paper called Zits.
Ha ha ha! Well, I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, you should try to catch it. It's in the Raleigh paper, because my friend from Raleigh sends me the funny papers, and it's also in ours. But it's a boy, and you know, it's very good. It really is.
Now, ladies, you talk about how important the choices that kids make at this age, how it can impact the rest of their lives, and I think that a lot of kids aren't really aware of that. And it would be good for the children to understand that these choices are going to impact the rest of their lives. I remember my older brother telling me maybe 20 years ago, that he was thinking, he'd been working in construction basically all his life, and he wanted to get back into computer science. He wanted to go back to school for computer science, and he did not have the underlying educational background. He said, I had no idea that the decisions that I made about what classes I took in high school were going to affect me now, because no one told him. And I had the same thing. I did not take any science classes in high school beyond the required, and no one ever told me that that was going to limit my choices of career down the road.
Hmm.
Do you have anything to say to that, Kristen, from your chapter mm-hmm. on academics?
Well, I think certainly a lot has changed academically in terms of the long-range implications of what kids are taking. And to speak to your issue first about having information, you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the roles of parents and teachers and others, is to provide the long-range view and to show kids how choices made today will affect the future, because kids are thinking just in the moment. They're so about the immediacy of their world.
Right.
The academic piece I could speak to. I think you probably want to hear also on these long range choices, the implications of these from a psychologist too. We can certainly revisit the academic piece, because a lot has changed in that realm as well.
Right, and you know, I've already mentioned the fact that girls are growing up at warp speed in this culture, that they're too sexy too soon. But we also wrote about drug use, that it's affecting kids at younger ages. Alcohol is the drug of choice for these kids, and most get their first drink at home from parents when they're in the fourth grade.
My goodness.
We interviewed a Dr. Mark Peel, a pediatric critical care physician and medical director of Wake Med Children's Hospital here in Raleigh. He told us that he's seen an uptick in kids snorting parents' prescription drugs. In fact, he said, one boy was brought to the ER hardly breathing, having snorted antidepressants, and he almost died. So I think it's that experts are witnessing this uptick in very high-risk behaviors. And these are not things that are just going to go away. You know, the early sexual experience begets depression, and low self-esteem. And when kids start drinking at such early ages, they are likely to keep it up. And also there's this whole issue of sexting. You know, our title is From Santa to Sexting. It's what we are implying is from innocence to danger.
Mm-hmm.
A sexting is using a mobile phone to swap sexually explicit, even nude images. And kids are doing this, and it may be that just a minority of kids are doing this, but this can have huge and serious repercussions. For example, in Lacey, Washington, a 13-year-old sent a nude image to her boyfriend that went around the school and later went viral. In fact, it's still on the internet today. And three middle schoolers were charged with misdemeanors and spent the night in jail. And this girl has now said that it was the stupidest thing she's ever done.
Yeah.
But there were two girls who actually committed suicide.
Yes.
After nude images of themselves went viral. So, you know, here we see that these choices, that some of the choices these kids are making in a thoughtless way can have terrible repercussions.
And I think it's more effective if the parent doesn't just say, don't do this, but explains why it's not a
yes.
good idea.
Yes.
No, I think this is Kristen speaking. You're absolutely right about providing context and reasons behind the rules. I think that, and all of what we're talking about, too, is just, this is only effective when it's done in the context of a warm and loving relationship. And it's one of the interesting things that we discovered as we went through the research is some of these very simple rituals are so effective at shoring up parent-child relationships and building family cohesion. And for example, the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University has done an annual drive to increase awareness about the importance of the family dinner, which is a very simple and humble ritual, but which has been shown to have a powerful effect for families to eat dinner five nights a week, parents and children together, a powerful impact on deterring substance abuse in kids. And we found that to be very encouraging and empowering for parents, that something so simple can have such a powerful effect on kids' decisions.
And in fact, we interviewed a woman, I would call her an amazing mom. Her name is Nilda Melendez. She and her husband, he's an engineer working for the government. They have nine children and live in the Washington, D.C. area. And their children range in age from young adults down all the way down to middle schoolers. But she said they always have the family dinner. And she said in the summertime, sometimes they would have it at 9 p.m. when Dad came home from work. But she just felt this was the time when kids would tell them about their day. And when they'd talk about the world's political scene, you know, this was a time of enlarging the world their children inhabited.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we interviewed one of her oldest children. We in Francisco Xavier, we end the book with an interview with him. He got into the Naval Academy in part by writing an essay about his mother in which he said that she ran a tight ship.
Yeah. Very good.
You know,
that was great. And he has he just said wonderful things about his family. And he grew up with parents who were quite strict, actually, and a mother who was a warm but no-nonsense person.
I love one of the things that he said, that his mother would give there were nine kids in the family, and if they were out of line, she would give them the look. That's it, when they got home. And I thought that was really cute.
You know, the legal repercussions of doing some things. Just this morning in the paper, the young man who secretly videoed his roommate who was having a sexual encounter with another boy, and put it on, you know, circulated it around and so forth. He is now facing up to 10 years in prison, but for invasion of privacy, because that boy committed suicide. Than the boy,
right.
the boy that was videoed,
right.
And so you know, it's not just the ones who are being bullied; it's also the bullies that they just don't realize what can happen to them too.
Well, the bringing up the issue of bullying is a huge and significant problem for middle schoolers. It's something that we heard quite a bit about, not just the traditional bullying, but cyberbullying as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one middle school principal told us the line, hurt people hurt people. And so one of the things that we looked into, too, was what is behind this upsurge in bullying.
Yes, and this was something that I did some doctoral work on years ago. It's something called attachment, and it's the emotional bond that children form with parents, mom and dad, in that first year of life. And one of the major things that happens in this particular first year is that children learn to be empathic. Now, bullies are lacking in empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the securely attached child grows up to be able to stand up to bullies and protect victims. But the insecurely attached child grows up to be the bully and the victim. And we compiled research on that. This is something new that we bring to the party in this book, is talking about empathy. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but schools are across America are, because of the upsurge in bullying, they're trying to teach children how to be empathic. But what we say is that empathy is caught, it's not taught.
Uh-huh.
Thought out of the way the parent treats the child from infancy on.
Right.
Well, how do you break that cycle then if you've got parents that are not good parents? And there are some, you know, that are abusive or
neglectful.
Neglectful. How do you get to that child?
Well, somebody has to show empathy to that child. And, you know, from time immemorial, there are those of us walking the face of the earth who've been influenced by a neighbor next door or a teacher, someone who was empathic and who cared for us and helped us, even like this principal who bought this party dress, this dance dress, for her, one of her eighth grade students. But I do think that the schools are not really understanding the genesis or the origin of empathy.
Mm.
And what they're having a kind of Band-Aid effect when they try to teach children to be empathic. It does come from the home. You know, parents have been outsourcing so many aspects of child rearing for decades now, and the family in this culture has been undermined. Recently we read that over 40% of the births in this country, the children are born to single women, to unmarried women. The family is the basic unit of society. It needs to be strong. It needs to be supported. And so parents need to get the help they need to be empathic parents.
So just to interject, this is Kristen, too. I think what you have is you have a lot of these factors coalescing where you have kids who are insecurely attached to their parents, and then in middle school you have a time where developmentally bullying peaks, and now we're bringing into this within the past, you know, in recent years, this explosion in mobile media and social networking and other elements we're bringing in, which has created a culture of cyberbullying that educators have told us is constant. And we do take a strong stand in the book on the fact that we don't believe that middle schoolers, kids in you know, 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, possess the maturity and the self-control to use a cell phone in an appropriate way. And I think that this, along with you know, the millions of kids who are under the age of 13 who really should not be on Facebook in the first place because they're violating the age requirement, we're seeing just an incidence of cyberbullying that is really out of control. And this we heard very consistently from educators about the depth of this problem.
Do you think that the lack of empathy is accentuated by what they watch on television? I mean, even cartoons. There are no more Bugs Bunny cartoons. Violence.
The violence on TV is horrendous. It's horrendous in most of the movies. Or a lot of them, but also in video games.
Oh, yeah.
Kristen might want to address that.
Well, I do. I mean, I think we're putting ourselves in sort of a strange double-bind situation in which we're lamenting, on the one hand, this explosion or upsurge in bullying, and at the same time, you see the huge, huge popularity in first-person shooter games among middle school boys, even while the research on the link between media violence and aggression is so incredibly well documented. I mean, there are few links in research that are as strongly documented as this. In fact, we see that the media violence aggression link is as strong in the research as the link between calcium consumption and bone mass. Everybody
wow.
knows you need calcium for your bones, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, I mean, these are very, very powerful linkages, and we're really making it hard for ourselves when kids are saturated in this sort of uber-violent media context, and at the same time, we're telling them, don't bully your peers.
That's right, and that's why we suggest that parents really be very careful with any of the video games. We interviewed a psychologist who talked about the addictive nature of gaming. And I'm not sure parents understand this or realize this, but it is a pretty common phenomenon that the more these children engage in watching video games, the more they become addicted to it. So, and the violence has an enormous effect upon their souls, their minds, their brains, their hearts. You know, we knew this decades ago when we saw that some books were good for kids and some other books depressed them, that mm-hmm. some music was okay and some music depressed them. I mean, music, literature, movies, video games, these are all powerful
and
their effect on kids.
They are very powerful, and in fact, there's a pediatrician named Dr. Michael Rich who is working at Harvard University at the Center on Media and Child Health, and he does call out these violent, the particularly violent video games, but he says that video games in particular are among the most powerful teaching technologies we have because it's a form of interactive media.
Mm.
It's even
right.
more powerful.
Right.
Than watching them.
Well, we have restrictions on movies, what young people are allowed to see in
supposedly.
A theater, anyway. Are there any such restrictions on video game sales?
Well, there is the Entertainment Safety Rating Board, which will rate games ranging from E for everyone to teen to mature. Most of the games that I'm talking about are rated M for mature. I think what we see, though, is that
but are retailers restricted from selling those to underage people?
No, and in fact, there was a big issue with the Supreme Court ruling recently. I mean,
yeah, I don't understand that. I mean,
why rate them if there doesn't make any difference?
Well, I mean, we do that for movies and theaters. What's
right,
the difference?
Right. There's been great reluctance to inhibit that, and you know, you see parents who would probably never allow their child to go to an R movie, who are willing to purchase M-rated games that their child is playing hours and hours on it.
Constantly.
And in fact, even this is the recent study that came out in 2011 in the journal Pediatrics on Gaming Addiction showed that about 10% of kids, this was elementary and middle school kids, were addicted to video games. This was a study that was done in Singapore, but they say that this statistic is consistent across cultures internationally, and in fact, the kids who were addicted at the threshold of addiction were playing 31 hours a week, which is incredible.
Well, really, the parents that are buying those games might actually appreciate a law that says you can't buy them for people under a certain age, because then it's not them having to say, no, you can't have this game, it's a law.
I don't know if you're aware of it, but even on the nightly news a few weeks ago, Brian Williams was stating that the FCC is thinking about removing restrictions for television programs in terms of the language that's used and the content.
Mm-hmm.
And already children of the middle school age can see programs like 16 and Pregnant and Glee, and just a lot of other kind of bizarre programming.
2.5 Men.
You know, before they go to bed at night.
Yeah.
So we live in, I think we need to take this view, this cultural view. We live in a culture that has removed protective restrictions in large measure when it comes to children. And we say in our book, and we believe, that middle schoolers are still
children. Yes.
They're coming out of childhood. At the same time, parents are living very high-stressed lives. I wrote a chapter in there called Where's the Fire? Parents are living under a lot of stress with dual-income parents, commuting, the economy, financial distress. And the research shows that the parents don't think their kids are under stress.
The kids are
stressing out.
Oh, yes.
And that overweight children are particularly sensitive to the distress. And they're
the ones that are most vulnerable for bullying too. A lot of times, did you know that there are vampire dolls in the stores now? I was appalled. Vampire dolls, complete with fangs and blood. I just honestly.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Dr. Brenda Hunter and Kristen Blair, mother and daughter. Author of From Santa to Sexting, Helping Your Child Safely Navigate Middle School and Shape the Choices That Last a Lifetime. Ladies, let's talk a little bit about how you worked together. Did you each take separate chapters, or how did that process work in writing this book?
Well, I think we both can address this. We just came up with, 12 or 13 ideas, and we split them down the middle based on our own strengths. And maybe Kristen wants to address that issue of what our particular strengths are.
Well, I've written in the education realm for years, and so have covered the academic issues, as I said, the bullying and cyberbullying and friendships and some of those. And my mom, of course, addressed those issues that have more psychological implications and just looking at it from her clinical expertise.
So you would write an entire chapter, and then would the other person help with the rewriting or editing at all? Or?
Oh, yes, we pass them back and forth many times. And I will say that one of the delightful things I learned in this whole process is that my daughter is a true workhorse. She has a fabulous work ethic. And sometimes I found that she pushed me.
Wow. You know, it's interesting. You two are engaged in something you obviously believe in as mother and daughter, and there is something really compelling about being able to have a cause or something that we feel passionate about together that's a shared goal. I think that in itself was quite rewarding. To do together.
Yeah, working with your adult children, really, I find very rewarding. My son works for me in business, and from a distance, he's in Austin, I'm in Iowa, but I have a number of businesses that he's involved with, and I really like having that connection with him on a day-to-day work basis. It's really fun. So, how did you find your publisher? Was this a publisher that you had used for a previous book or not?
Well, no. I actually started out with a literary agent, and Kristen quickly came on board, and he just submitted it to a variety of publishers. And Leafwood, interestingly enough, decided they wanted to do it, and the man who basically bought the idea said, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and what these women are saying is true.
Mm-hmm.
So you pitched the book at a concept level, or did you have it outlined at that point?
A book proposal. We put together a book proposal that, using the format our literary agent suggested, and he shopped it. But often he found that some of the people who expressed initial interest did not really grasp what middle schoolers were facing because they were young and they had younger children. So it was at Leafwood that we finally found somebody who had a middle school daughter, and he knew what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Now, as your agent was shopping it around, were you already starting the writing process?
Well, I think some of the ideas were germinating. I mean, we had put together a book proposal based on impressions that we had, research we had seen, conversations that we'd had across time, and just were sort of thinking through some of the different components and aspects of this. But but we didn't really roar into action with the focus group, which was kind of the impetus for getting started until we had signed a contract.
Okay. Now, you said the book proposal format was suggested by your agent. Can you give us some hints about that? I know there's a lot of different formats out there, a lot of different suggestions about how to do a nonfiction book proposal that range from a few pages to 50 pages.
Well, I think I can't remember how long ours was. It was maybe 15 pages.
I think about 30.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But this is my 12th book. And I've found that, you know, I've had to do the same thing over and over again with each book. And generally they want to know, you know, who the audience would be, what's your competition, how's your book the same, how's your book different. If you've published before, they want to know what your book sales have been. And then just why you're the best person to write this book. Then you do a sample chapter. And also we had to delineate all the chapters we would write and give chapter summaries. So you really have a very good roadmap when you get a publisher and you sit down to write your book, because you've already hammered out so many different aspects.
How long did it take you to put the proposal together?
I don't know, a month.
Oh. I think... Carolyn and Monica, one of the other issues too is this sense of, is there a real felt need for the book?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a real need for this? And I think one of the responses that we've gotten as people have gotten back to us in terms of their feedback on the book is that there is a huge felt need for this kind of a book, and that and we've talked a lot about some statistics today, some of which are fairly alarming, but one of the real heartfelt goals that we have had in writing this book is to empower and encourage parents, and from some inspiring stories to the very, very practical, but just to remind parents that they have great power, and this is not a message that they're hearing a lot in the culture, and that there are many, many things that they can do. So meeting that felt need was a critical component of the book writing process, and casting that vision in the beginning was as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I could safely say that for both of us, this is a cause. Mm. This is not just a literary endeavor.
Right.
And since I have written other books in the past, I would say that I don't like to spend a year or so of my life on a project that I don't deeply believe in. Mm. And so we really are... believe very strongly that this age group is pivotal, as we've said before, that the choices these kids make will shape the rest of their lives, and that parents need to hang on to the rope and stay engaged with their children and help them make good choices.
Dr. Hunter, would you read from one of your chapters in the book?
Okay. Well, I wrote a chapter on Where's the Fire? Just a little prelude. When Kristen had young children and I was visiting, one morning she was rushing about, and I grew up in the coffee klatch era, you know, when women could sit down at 9 o'clock and have a cup of coffee without guilt. Remember that?
No, I don't.
Wait, I said to her, "Here's the fire," and we laughed, and her friend started saying it after a while. But this is a chapter on stress, on the stress that people are facing when they lose jobs, when they're busy and distracted, and the stress their children face. And so this is my little vignette. Yesterday, my husband and I celebrated our 37th wedding anniversary. But early in our marriage, this is a second marriage, as you can imagine. Early in our marriage, Don lost his job and was unemployed for 4 long months in the dead of winter. Christmas was bleak that year. The girls got any money we had, and we charged our $50 gifts for each other. Our meager savings account was soon depleted, and we felt stressed to the max. Don, a lawyer who had left his job at Boeing in Seattle after the company failed to reward him for his ace negotiation of a $2.7 billion contract, had tried diligently to find another job in Asheville, North Carolina, to no avail. One day, when we were at the end of our resources, Don had lunch with the vice president of one of the local banks. I shall always remember his face when the vice president dropped him off at our home. Without saying a word, Don let me know that he hadn't gotten the job. As we walked into the house, I said, "What will we do now?" Don replied, "There's only one thing to do, call Boeing." It was hard for him to swallow his pride, pick up the phone, and call his former boss, Dale. But we were desperate. Before he dialed the number, Don and I prayed and asked God for a positive outcome. We had about $100 in the bank. Dale was not only warm and friendly, but asked Don if he could be in the office on Monday. It was now late Friday afternoon. Don said he could, but with real emotion in his voice, he asked Dale for airfare. Truth was, we couldn't afford to pay for his flight to New Jersey. After a brief silence, Dale said, "I'll have a ticket waiting for you at the airport." That was when Don and I learned to believe God when he says that he will never abandon us, leave us, or forsake us, but will provide for us like a father. Funny thing, Holly and Crispin do not remember that time as particularly stressful.
Yeah, that's because you were able to get through it and not make them feel like it was their fault. I heard that so many times from kids at school when I was a teacher, that when their parents divorced, they thought it was their fault. And I thought, oh gosh, parents, you got to talk to your kids, you know?
Well, ladies, we're out of time. And that's too bad because there's more to talk about.
There's a lot more to talk about. And if you're a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a teacher, anybody cares about kids, or you have friends who have kids, this is the book you really need to read.
From Santa to Sexting by Dr. Brenda Hunter and Kristen Blair. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And one last quick question. What's next? Are you going to write another book together?
Oh, we're going to promote this book. We have so much to do to get this out.
Oh, I'll bet.
We want to spread the word and empower parents. So that's next on the docket.
Well, we hoped we helped a little bit doing that.
All right.
Well, we think
absolutely.
You did.
We think you did.
And you can listen to this interview again Monday morning at 8 a.m. and on KRUUFM.com. It will be up on the archives, and on writersvoices.com. It will be available there as well.
And I have a parting thing which I think is applicable here. Albert Einstein said, "The world is a dangerous place, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it."
Great quote.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.